In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
The problem with success is that people come to expect it. And Trump is especially not immune from that. No one is 100% successful 100% of the time. This seems to be a pattern for Trump. Lots of success and then less than success. Unfortunately, too many of his alleged base pounce on his mistakes and are all too eager to jump on the criticism bandwagon, as if one or a few mistakes somehow negates dozens of wins. Or perhaps there's a part of them psychologically that want to knock somebody down who's successful, so they focus on the mistakes rather than the wins. It's their inner socialist showing through. For whatever reason, Trump seems to go through little bouts of sometimes big mistakes. He has tremendous win after win after win, and then there's this cooling down where he seems to drop his guard a little. Battle fatigue, maybe. Because seemingly out of the blue, he has a series of missteps and bad ideas. In political terms, it's like he's on his period. Thankfully, it's not every month, and then he regroups, regains his strength, and there are weeks and months of wins ahead. I think Trump does better when he can see giants and dragons on the horizon to go slay. He doesn't do as well when there's not a major battle to be won. No one's perfect, but no one is better when there's a battle to be won than President Trump. This week, after huge wins on his recent Asia tour, securing deals with half a dozen major trading partners, eliminating China as the roadblock to much-needed rare earth minerals, and simultaneously taking away China's strategic trading advantage, Trump won the Democrats' shutdown without giving in or paying the Democrats' ransom demands, while the Democrats lost big time, including losing face with Democrats. And with that de-escalation, Trump floated some mistaken ideas out there. 50-year mortgages, a plan to give $2,000 checks to people from tariff revenue while we're still deficit spending about $2 trillion every year, and that whole $38 trillion in debt thing. Recently, he even said 500,000 Chinese students coming here to attend our universities is somehow a good thing that MAGA wants. Yeah, he needs a new battle to fight. But the good news is that's out of his system, and we can look forward to those weeks and months ahead of battles being won. And one of the bigger ones out there is the rise of socialism. And not just anywhere, but in the heart of capitalism, New York City, the financial center of America and of the world. Maybe when Trump said that America will never be a socialist country, the Democrats and socialists and communists all took that as a challenge and pulled out all the stops to win in New York City. Or could that have been a trap? By winning New York City, socialism's punitive taxes to pay for all the free stuff Mamdani promised, businesses will leave for freer states. The socialists don't know it yet, but they could have just decentralized major portions of banking and finance and big business as those companies relocate elsewhere, taking their wealth and lucrative jobs with them to red states and taking it away from blue state New York. Socialism depends on control, centralized control, and there they go, fleeing the prison walls. And the great thing? All of those leaving are about to learn what it's like to live in a freer state, with fewer regulations and more freedom to follow that American dream and create more wealth in the process for themselves and those red states. I think we're likely to see there's going to be a honeymoon in New York City for a while, as there always is when socialism wins. The inability to distinguish between reality and fantasy is why some people think socialism works, temporarily, because eventually the bills for free stuff come due. And then all the useful idiot voters and wannabe socialists, formerly of the middle and lower classes, suddenly wake up to the slavery that is socialism, because nothing is free. To get a little economic intelligence, I'd like to welcome back Jonathan Williams. He's the president and the chief economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council. You can find out about what they do by heading to alec.org. That's ALEC.org. Jonathan, good to talk to you again.
Well, Mark, always great to be back with you, my friend.
Yeah, I know that you say Washington, D.C. is the land of make-believe, and you had some weird things happen there, not necessarily in Washington, D.C., but in Virginia. Last week, we had talked about the recent elections there. Last week in New York City, Virginia and New Jersey. And I got to ask you this, because you live in Virginia. Did it surprise you that Virginians saw no problem voting for and electing an attorney general who wanted his political opponents murdered?
Well, yes, it does surprise me, and it should shock everyone that someone like that was just elected as the top law enforcement official for the Commonwealth of Virginia here. I thought that while the trends in the poll lines, in the long-term trends, probably taking a step back for Virginia, Mark, is you go back 50-plus years, and the party that's out of power in the White House almost always wins the Virginia governor's race. Terry McAuliffe was the one that broke that over the last half century, and so it's not a surprise that the governor's race turned out that way when you look at the history of it. While Winsome Sears is a good friend, and I think she had a great vision for Virginia in the future, that voters reverted back to the historical patterns, I think, of the last 50 years in Virginia on that race. Now, when you look at the attorney general's race, where you have an incumbent, Jason Meores, who served admirably over the last 4 years, ALEC alumnus from his time in the state house, representing the Virginia Beach area, going down by, it looks like, over 5 percentage points now to Jay Jones, also a delegate, but someone who you referenced had made those comments that recently came to light via text message there about the former Speaker of the House, Todd Gilbert, and just reprehensible comments. And I thought that regardless of what was going on top of the ticket or national headwinds right now for conservatives, that voters in Virginia would have thought twice before electing someone with that kind of a temperament. Now, obviously, it remains to be seen how he will govern in office. I hope it's far different than he governed in private text messages, but the verdict is still going to be out on that one, obviously.
Yeah, it was really shocking for somebody on the outside like us to see, especially in the wake of the Charlie Kirk murder. It would have been one thing if he just kind of said that in isolation, but learning about that after Charlie Kirk was murdered, after two assassination attempts on Trump, and here's this guy wishing death, not just on his political opponents, but on their kids. That, I think, was the real shocking thing.
Well, it sure was. And as a father myself, as you know, Mark, of young kids, that is beyond the pale. I mean, mm-hmm. You cannot be entrusted with public support, you would think, if you make those kind of comments about your political opponents and their children, and especially comparing your political opponents to Hitler and Pol Pot and others, and then saying you'd rather shoot your political opponent. I mean, that is just disqualifying from the very get-go, I would think.
Yeah, I would think so as well. So just to kind of get the ball rolling here with our discussion, let's kind of start very broadly. We've had the government shut down, so a lot of the numbers that we would normally see just haven't been there. But what do you think right now about the overall state of the economy? Because I know that Trump just recently tweeted out that Thanksgiving prices are down 25% from Biden 2024. So, just a year ago, that seems at least an improvement. And I'm certainly seeing that myself in the grocery store. I'm seeing a lot of prices coming down.
Well, right. I mean, and you go to the gas pump, for instance, and, you can fill up here, even in the metro D.C. area, for about $2.75 a gallon.
Well,
I know that probably bleeds into another topic that we want to discuss in states like Oregon wanting to raise transportation taxes yet again. And you happen to be in California here. And last time I was in California, it was still $5 a gallon for gasoline. And so, I think what we're seeing is different pockets of affordability or lack of affordability around the country, based in many cases on the decision make that state and local policymakers are making when it comes to taxes and regulations and the Green New Deal style policies that are making it very unaffordable still in parts of the country, where affordability is going to be a major theme, I think, in the coming months when it comes to policy ideas. But then in others, as you allow the market to adjust and you allow things to come back to normal, in many cases coming out of the Biden era, you are seeing a reduction in the cost of living when government gets out of the way. And I think that's really the big differentiation here, Mark, is we have 50 laboratories of democracy, and this is a great way to see what's working and what's not working when you have a market-driven economy in so many places where costs are coming down and so many of the good things that are happening federally with the dereg and tax cuts are being allowed to work versus those state and local governments that are still putting roadblocks in the way to affordability.
Yeah, well, government getting out of the way, that's really interesting because that's one of the things I want to talk to you about coming up, about socialism, and that is definitely not government getting out of the way. But you mentioned pockets of good news and bad news, and I'd like to pick that up because there seems to be some of that also in the broader economy as well here, in particular about the October jobs reports. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more with Jonathan Williams. He's the president and chief economist at ALEC, that's American Legislative Exchange Council. And welcome back. Jonathan Williams is the president and chief economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council. Jonathan, even though the shutdown is over, I do want to talk about the Democrats' extortion demands here. But before we get there, the October jobs, I mentioned this on the way out, is that there was an article by MSNBC that was a bit shocking that said the job cuts in October hit the highest level in 22 years. And these are not official numbers because the government was shut down. And yet, on the other side, according to ADP, private payrolls rose 42,000 in October, nearly double what the Dow Jones was expecting. But just some bullets from that article. They said layoff announcements soared in October as companies recalibrated staffing levels during the artificial intelligence boom, a sign of potential trouble ahead for the labor market. Job cuts for October totaled 153,000, a 183% surge from September, and a 175% higher than the same month a year ago. It was the highest level for any October since 2003 and has been the worst year for layoffs since 2009. Companies in the tech sector announced 33,000 job cuts, nearly six times that level in September. So are these mainly government jobs and or due to the shutdown, or is there something else happening we should be concerned about?
Well, just a kind of a starting point is really important to just remind folks of the differences in the way that these two sets of numbers can come about. So, I mean, you have the official jobs numbers that get a lot of the top end headlines from the media, especially mm-hmm. when they tell a story the media would like to be told.
Yes.
And that's coming from the BLS. And there's been a lot of discussion of President Trump's dissatisfaction with the Bureau of Labor Statistics there and his nominee for the replacement of the head of BLS to try to get to better reporting and more accurate reporting. And that what that does, of course, is it looks like it's a survey, first of all, is important to note. So there's a lot of limitations when you're surveying, and you know, you maybe don't get survey responses from a lot of employers. That's an important key, because I think the response rate to those surveys has been languishing in recent years, especially coming out of the pandemic. And so you get a partial picture of that. The other limitation, Mark, as you know, of the BLS numbers that we see reported so much is that the total number reported includes government jobs as a part of that. And so obviously that's something we harped on during the Biden administration, where they used it to make it look like the jobs numbers were rosy because they were adding government jobs and the distorting the overall number. Now, of course, you might see some of that in reverse today, where because of the needed look at reducing the amount of bureaucracy in Washington, D.C., and the Trump administration's focus on that, you're going to see some negative numbers on that side of the equation, even if private sector employers are adding in many cases. And so getting over to the ADP numbers, I mean, that looks specifically at those payroll actual numbers from the companies. And
right,
so I think it's a much more accurate view of what's happening, certainly on the private sector side of the economy versus survey data that also commingles public and private sector hiring. So I'm a much bigger fan of looking at ADP numbers versus the overall BLS estimates.
Yes, yeah, and I agree with you on that one. That article did mention something that I think is of concern to some people, myself included, and they're saying that companies recalibrated staffing during the rise of artificial intelligence. And is that something that Alec is concerned about? Because I'm pretty sure, if I remember right, Amazon just laid off like 14,000 workers in large part because they're looking at automating so much of their warehousing.
Well, I think it's certainly a discussion point that we're having as we all kind of figure out what does AI look like, not just 10 years from now and not just a year from now, but I'm not so sure that anybody knows what it's going to look like just a number of months from now. And it's emerging very quickly. And so I think those are all big picture questions, is how much does it in fact affect private sector employment overall, or I should say employment generally? And then if it does affect that, and it will to some degree, what are the things that we can be doing to think ahead of the curve, to have retraining opportunities and abilities to really shape careers that will be immune from being replaced by AI technology. And so I think that's a robust conversation for state and local policymakers, especially when you look at ways that states can prioritize education for the future and making sure that we're looking at putting those limited dollars that we have on public education, especially whether it's K-12 or higher ed, into the careers that will actually make a big difference going forward.
Well, I think you're right. Is AI is something to be concerned about, and I think that's a whole huge topic that you and I could spend on pretty much an entire show on. But moving on, I would like to talk to you about the shutdown. It finally ended Sunday night when the Democrats surrendered. And now that it's ending, let's take a moment to remember that Democrats were willing to starve people to give them free health care. I think that's pretty astonishing when you think of it that way. But they really got nothing other than the exact deal that was on the table right from the very beginning. Reopen the government, and then we can talk about other issues. But I really suspect that their attempts to extort more from the government for nationalized health care is not over. I guess the Democrats are allowed to write the bill, and then there's going to be a floor vote on that. What do you expect that fight in December is going to look like? Do you anticipate more attempts at hostage taking?
Well, I think that may be the case. I mean, and you know, the thing is like you described it as you kicked it off. The thing that shocked me as I saw the Wall Street Journal headline last night come through, as they said it was the Democrats that came to the table to reopen the government. I mean, that was kind of a laughable headline, even from the Wall Street Journal. Yes. I wouldn't have expected it from that outlet. But I mean, here we have nearly all Republicans now for the last couple of months. Looking to keep the government open as a clean continuing resolution. You had holdouts, obviously, as you mentioned, that were playing hostage with SNAP benefits on the left and other items on health care. And the headlines read, it was the Democrats that reopened the government. And, you know, this is clearly something that was not based in reality, as you had Leader Thune leading the debate for so many days here in Washington, talking about the costs to real people's lives for those on the left that wanted to add new policy into something after they voted so many times to keep the government open and a clean CR in previous past. I mean, even Leader Schumer had done that numerous times. And so and both sides were dug in and thought they were winning the political debate around it. Now, you could probably say you had some incentive for those on the left to say, let's keep the government closed until we get through the midterm elections here in Virginia and New Jersey and see if that helps us. And maybe it did. And maybe that was their goal. I don't know. But at least we're moving towards some sort of a resolution. It moves over to the House, where Speaker Johnson obviously has a very narrow majority. But it seems like Republicans are going to hold together to have a clean CR. And then your guess is as good as mine in terms of December. I mean, as you know, many of these things come every single year as the must-pass items right before people leave for the holidays. And Mark, the history of our national debt is probably littered with lots of big spending ideas that get thrown into must-pass bills on about December 21st or 22nd here in Washington. So I'm always nervous of late December deals as it relates to the American taxpayer in our future. But I mean, nonetheless, we are heading in a much more positive direction because I think those on the Democrat side of the aisle that came to get the 60 votes in the Senate, clearer heads prevailed, and they realized that whatever they were negotiating on behalf of, it wasn't going to make it very long.
Yeah. Well, the other thing about December, these kinds of bills in December, is that a lot of people just simply are not paying attention due to the holidays and all that. And that is a problem if they're trying to push some major legislation. And it needs grassroots input, but unfortunately, people just aren't paying attention to that. Okay, let's take a break there. Coming up in a later segment, we're going to talk about socialism in America. But first, Trump's tariffs have done tremendous good by bringing countries to the negotiation table and brought billions, trillions in economic activity to America. Could the Supreme Court undo all that good? That and more with Jonathan Williams, president of the American Legislative Exchange Council. And welcome back. We're talking today to Jonathan Williams. He is the president and chief economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council. You can visit their website at alec.org, and we'll link that up on today's show page, which is 15-46 on iSpyRadio.com. And so, Jonathan, I mentioned going out there about these tariffs. They have done a tremendous amount of good, I think, for America in general, certainly America in general. But also, a lot of people really had, I think, misjudged what Trump was trying to do with tariffs. And a large part of it was simply just to get these unfair trade practices by other countries against us to force them to come to the trade negotiation table. Overall, what have you thought of Trump's tariffs?
Well, you know, obviously there was the Liberation Day moment in April where markets really had the the tough several days, and I think there was a lot of angst and worry up front of, you know, what was being outlaid there. And, you know, I was interviewed around that point in time, and I, you know, I said, you know, hey, we're not fans of taxes, and, you know, you can see tariffs as taxes. So as a principled policy, we don't see them as like something we want to see high for a long period of time as a revenue generator, but to use them as a art of the deal, which is, I think, where the president has always been on this, because in the first term, he offered the G7, go to zero and we'll go to zero, and they rejected it, right? I mean, so I think, you know, it's always been an art of the deal moment, and there's some, I think, healthy internal discussions within probably the White House right now as to, you know, different elements wanting to see one side of that win out versus others. But I mean, bringing other countries to the table to say, hey, you know, you have been, you know, issuing all kinds of discriminatory policies to the United States for many years or many decades in some cases, and you need to treat us fairly, and we'll work on a deal that will lower the cost of doing business in each direction. I mean, that at the end of the day, Trump is a deal maker. He wrote the book, and I think that's the playbook he still operates on. And, you know, I do think, you know, there are some concerns legitimately around some certainty issues for some businesses here. But those are things that I think are going to be worked out. You have Secretary Bessent, who I think has done a phenomenal job during this administration, both on taxes and on discussions around trade to keep things on the straight and narrow. And so he's, I think, one of the unsung heroes of this administration so far. And one thing I will mention is that even if folks have some legitimate concern around certainty when it comes to tariffs, you know, one of the things that does not get nearly enough airtime on other shows, I know you talk about this a lot, Mark, but, you know, this is the Trump tax cuts, the one big beautiful bill, one of the unsung elements of that was the certainty that we have now in the tax code for the first time in decades. Mm-hmm. I mean, people forget that we were operating perpetually in temporary tax codes since the Bush tax cuts of 2001. And you go for too long and you see so much uncertainty, which keeps capital on the sidelines in the tax code. And now is not only lower rates and better business treatment in that one big beautiful bill, but now you have a permanent tax code, not just on the business side, but for a tax code for individuals. And that's something that I think is a huge deal when it comes to the economy going forward.
Well, I think uncertainty in politics is very much the bread and butter of politics, is they love that uncertainty because you got to elect us to save that, or you got to elect us to stop that. So this notion that it was out there, you never knew where it was going to go. I think a lot of people were probably okay with that. As far as the tariffs are concerned themselves, you know, being for free markets, I have generally been opposed to tariffs over the years, especially if tariffs are really just protectionism, because protecting your own industry to block competition means the protected industry won't feel the pressure of competition and so won't look very hard for innovation and ways to cut costs because they know that the government's got their back, and that ends up hurting their customers. And I really wish there were genuine free markets, but the moment that one country puts a tariff on us, there's no longer free markets. And at that point, I'm all for it, especially when tariffs are used, as Trump did, to force countries to renegotiate and to get to a fair deal. Go ahead.
And one point on that, the other element of this that I think a lot of people may not think through enough is just the national security element of a lot of this when it comes to key production elements that it's clear that we need to be producing in the United States, whether that's rare earth minerals and the not only the mining of it, but the refining of it, having that in the United States when we've seen the threats against our country and against our manufacturing base by communist China saying we're going to cut you off from magnets and rare earth minerals. That's not acceptable. And you go down the list of whether it's active pharmaceutical ingredients or the advanced semiconductor chips, those are all things that from a strategic national perspective and national defense perspective, we need to have a key element in the United States. And that, you know, goes beyond the supply and demand of markets or the typical tax or tariff discussion.
Well, and I absolutely agree with that. As far as the tariffs are concerned, well, before we get there, actually, because there was that big Supreme Court hearing on November 5th, but before we get there, you know, Trump started off this most recent presidency by going to the Middle East, came back with about $2.5 trillion in hard deals. They're saying over time it'll be about $14 trillion, if I remember right. And then he went to Europe, got the grand royal treatment there in Britain, came away with a whole another round of multi-trillion-dollar deals from Europe. Now he's off to Asia, and he's gotten some more. As far as I know, he hasn't yet planned to go to Antarctica, but I'm guessing he'll get there. But as far as Asia is concerned, that was a fantastic trip, and it really demonstrated, I thought, the whole, you know, Trump's ability to negotiate and the art of the deal, because he made all of those little side trips to get rare earth agreements from Southeast Asia and then also Japan. And he gets all of those things in place, effectively negating China's stranglehold over the rare earth. And then he finishes that with China. So what were your thoughts on the Asia trip? I mean, how would you grade him?
No, I think it was a huge success for the president and for our country, more importantly. When you look at not just the idea of onshoring manufacturing, like I was talking about with the career, you know, areas of concern, I think we absolutely need to think broadly about friendshoring, right? The concept of making sure that if we can't produce things here domestically for whatever reason, or it's difficult to have an on-ramp to get this done in a short period of time, that we absolutely need to look to our friends, and especially friends in a strategic sense in Asia right now. And that's been something that, you know, George W. was a big proponent of this, and others, that we absolutely need to lean into our friends in Asia and in other countries that are of strategic importance right now. And so I think the timing of that was a stroke of genius from the president, and the results, I think, will be a great long term for the United States.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Okay, so we didn't quite get to the questions on tariffs as far as the Supreme Court is concerned. We will do that next with Jonathan Williams. He's the president and chief economist at ALEC, that's the American Legislative Exchange Council. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking today to Jonathan Williams. He is the president and chief economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council. You can visit them at alec.org. That's alec.org. And Jonathan, I'd like to get your thoughts on the recent Supreme Court hearing, which was on November 5th, that had to deal with the question of tariffs. And at the heart of the question is whether tariffs are an executive or congressional power, and who is going to be handling these tariffs. And the irony, I think, is kind of twofold. One, that the Democrats say Trump is acting as a king with these tariffs, and two, that in Marxist countries, which Democrats say they want to be, well, gosh, the glorious leader there acts with impunity and does what he wants, setting tariffs. Plus, in socialist countries, the government is the king and controls the means of production, but also property ownership and the means of trade. So it's not that Democrats don't want kings, it's just that they want their kings. But as far as the Supreme Court hearing on November 5th, it didn't necessarily seem to bode very well for Trump, but my understanding is that if they rule against him, it does not negate the current deals, but it would only impact the future deals. Is that how you understand things as well?
Well, I've heard those, both of the theories on which way that might go. I do think it would create a fairly large issue, right, if it goes retroactively and all of a sudden you have this pretty large amount of tariff revenue collection that would have to be refunded, that, you know, I don't think that's a practical option at this point. So I would hope the court would look probably in the future on whatever they decide. You know, and Mark, it won't surprise you, I'm very much a legislative branch, you know, guy when it comes to the states, unsurprisingly working at a legislative organization such as ALEC. And I do think, you know, from many people's perspective in Congress has abrogated their authority in so many different ways. And that's a big problem, I think, for us generally. And so I do think Congress needs to be more active in many areas. Now, that's in theory great. In practice, given the way that Congress has operated in recent times and narrow margins, it's probably not likely we're going to see them take huge decision points here. But it will remain to be seen where the court goes. I mean, I think if you read the tea leaves, they're probably going to be likely to have a narrow majority against the administration on this. I may be wrong about this, but that's what I can tell from my observation of how the arguments went. Obviously, that can change a bit as we go in the final ruling, as we see here.
Yeah, well, the whole tariffs idea, as far as trying to bring it under legislative control, I mean, we just went through a government shutdown and Congress can't even keep the government open. I mean, do we really want the legislative branch to be solely in charge of trade negotiations? They can't agree on anything and they probably just give away everything. So as far as, in the middle of the shutdown, there was the discussion about the hostage taking, that they were holding the government hostage in order to force a vote on keeping these subsidies going for Obamacare. And those were interesting because they were never intended to be permanent. They were simply subsidies issued during the COVID era increase. And we had a previous guest on, Lisa Lettmeyer. She's an insurance expert, does a lot with Medicare. And what she was saying is under those subsidies here in Oregon, some couples who were making up to $175,000 were getting free health care. And that's what the Democrats were trying to save, in addition to the fact that billions of dollars were being given away under the state side of Medicaid to illegal immigrants. And, you know, the issue is that, like any other socialist program, you get people used to something, they perceive it as free, and then the Democrats, in this case, well, they will threaten that the Republicans are trying to take it away. And just like that, another $1 trillion goes out the window on free health care. So that's kind of where we're at, as far as I understand it, with the whole Democrats and what they're trying to do in December now.
Well, yeah, it's. I think this was a clearly thought out political strategy to try to move the conversation towards health care costs and hope that Americans didn't notice the difference when it comes to who are actually benefiting from some of these COVID era enhanced subsidies. But I think, you know, the question that nobody's talking about right now is, why is health care so expensive in this country?
Yeah.
As you know, we hear it was, you know, well over a decade ago, we passed the so-called Affordable Care Act that was supposed to make health care affordable again in the United States. And what have we seen? We've seen premiums go up. We've seen so many companies exit the market. And then we've seen profitability for the large insurers, the people that were supposed to be targeted by Obamacare, even though they supported Obamacare, as we've a lot of times folks forget that part, is the whole kind of healthcare industrial complex lined up and supported Obamacare. And so, not that profits are a bad thing when they're gained from market forces, but when they're gained by government monopoly or government subsidies in these cases, I mean, that creates a real problem. And so I think that we're missing the larger point, in that hopefully conservatives here in Capitol Hill and the states double down on answering these questions around affordability broadly, which was a big theme in this election this fall, and I think it's going to be an even bigger theme in the 2026 elections. And what is it that's driving health care costs? You know, why can't customers see the prices of things when they're at hospitals and be able to shop around to see where can we find the best value? And then, you know, why is it that, you know, for instance, you can't buy insurance across state lines in so many cases? I mean, so many common sense policy ideas that for whatever reason have become harder to solve because of the so-called Affordable Care Act, and not easier. And so I think states, you know, this is going to be where we're going to be working at from an ALEC perspective, is looking at how we can find more patient-centered healthcare options for individuals across the United States, whether that's insurance or not. But what the president's talking about right now, of giving money back to individuals to allow them to really shop for the best kind of healthcare for themselves, I think is exactly the direction we need to head.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, but you beat me to it, because I think it's a brilliant idea. It takes it out of the insurance company's hands and, again, pushes those monies down to the individual. And I hope he was kind of vague on what that is, but I would suspect that's going to be part of the debate in December, is that the Republicans will be pushing, okay, so let's maybe put the money in people's hands rather than insurance companies' hands. Do you think the president is talking basically of funding health savings accounts for people?
I think that's very possible, you know, and it would be very much on brand with the administration's goals of doing the same in education, as we've talked about, of getting more dollars in the hands of parents and families to make those critical decisions around their child's education needs. Same thing applies. I mean, there's no reason why we shouldn't empower consumers, empower Americans to make those choices that only they should decide for themselves in their future. The first step, of course, is making sure they know what options are there in a realistic market with prices. And that's something that's lacking in so many states across the country. And that's something that we at ALEC, with our hospital price transparency model that's now passing across the country, are trying to create a market. Because when you don't have price signals, you don't have a market. And when
that's
you
right.
don't have a market, we shouldn't be surprised when healthcare costs are going up at the rate that they have since Obamacare's passage.
Yeah, absolutely right. So, okay, let's go and take our break there. Come back when we talk about socialism in America. We'll do that with Jonathan Williams. He's the president and the chief economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council. Visit them at alec.org. Jonathan Williams is the president and the chief economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council. And Jonathan, going out of that last break there, we were talking about socialism here in America. And I really think that's the next big fight here. Ideologically speaking, in America, we just had openly Democratic Socialists, which basically means communist, mayor elected in New York City. And, you know, talk about competition among the states. Now, a whole bunch of states are trying to woo New York City businesses considering leaving New York City and to get them to relocate to their states. I mean, even Louisiana was out there saying, hey, if you're thinking of leaving New York City, come here. And Louisiana is not a state that I would usually think of in terms of trying to woo corporations, but it's open season now, trying to bag New York businesses. So there you go. There's your competition among the 50 test tubes.
No doubt. I mean, if I were a economic development leader in any state or local area around the United States, I'd be doing the same thing to say, you know, look at our state for better quality of life and lower cost of life. And you know, so many states like Louisiana that you mentioned, much lower taxes, much better education options for parents now with their school choice law. And, you know, if you want actual opportunities, you know, for growth as individuals or as businesses, they're likely not going to happen, unfortunately, in Mondami's New York.
Yeah, no, they certainly weren't. So, in preparing for the show and this segment in particular, I got to thinking about an old quote. Plato, some 400 years before Christ, said, "One of the penalties for refusing to participate in politics is that you end up being governed by your inferiors." And in much the same way, one of the penalties for refusing to learn basic economics is that you end up voting for socialism. And I think that's a large part of the fight ahead, is that people just need better information about socialism. Are you guys at ALEC, are you doing any focus on socialism to try to help push the education needle in terms of why socialism is bad for economies?
Well, we certainly are, and we're going to be really outlining our priorities for 2026 here in the next several weeks. And part of that's going to be a ALEC affordability agenda when it comes to housing affordability, when it comes to energy affordability, when it comes to just affordability generally on taxes and regulations. And so I think we're going to have very clear lines of distinction between what actually drives affordability based on market ideas and ALEC policy ideas for states versus in rhetoric. What people like Mr. Mondami talk about for affordability, because that's really the big irony is, yes, he's a DSA member, probably a Marxist, not to mention an anti-Semite at the same time, and just a horrific potential leader for New York City. I'm just saddened for the future of New York City, America's largest city, really an incredible place otherwise. But I think they made a grave error here. And, you know, but the interesting thing about that election in New York City, Mark, was the theme of Mr. Mondami was, how do we make New York more affordable? And he comes up with all these big government ideas like government-run grocery stores. I mean, really? I mean, this isn't the Soviet Union circa 1984, I don't think. And last time I checked, none of that worked over a long period of time. But he sold that agenda, and he tapped into at least the fears of New Yorkers to say, you know, things are unaffordable. How do we address it? Unfortunately, all of his solutions, as we know, based on history, are going to make it that much worse. But it does say something that his slick political operatives that were running his campaign decided that they wanted to focus on affordability. So I think that is where the fault lines are going to be at going into 2026, into the state legislative sessions, and then probably a longer-term discussion into the elections of 2026. But from our policy perspective, what we're going to be talking about is, what are the market ideas and what are the common sense policy solutions that states can address to look at affordability holistically in a way that actually does move prices lower and make those states more affordable?
Yeah, well, it's always a bit of an irony when people like Mondami, socialists, are saying, well, we need to focus on affordability, but how are you supposed to afford things when the government takes more money from you? That's kind of self-defeating.
Well, I'm right. And how is government going to afford those things as it chases out the productive individuals who are the ones that are funding the government coffers to begin with?
Right.
We know New York is down, you know, thousands of its wealthy and its entrepreneurs and others looking for opportunity in other states. This is only going to hasten that out-migration effect as people vote with their feet, as we measure every year in rich states, poor states, leaving New York and its coffers even less well off than they have been in the past.
Yeah. I really don't know what's going to happen with New York City. I do think that there's going to be, like I said in my opener, I think there's going to be a bit of a honeymoon, perhaps fueled by socialist billionaires or other outsiders or NGOs who try to flood New York City with more money and cash to make it seem like socialism works, because Mondami is not going to be able to just suddenly raise taxes that he'll need to raise in order to pay for all the free stuff he promised. It will have to be gradual. Especially if he doesn't want to scare off businesses. And from the everyday people's side, there will probably be a temporary kind of delusional high where things maybe do start to get affordable for a little bit, but eventually somebody's got to pay for all that. And, you know, socialism...
Well, that's the inherent problem with socialism.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's the problem is you run out of other people's money very quickly.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
And if you put a large percentage of the rental units in the city under rent control and you have these government-run grocery stores and all the other big government ideas, you're right. In the short term, it may look very good. It may feel very good for some individuals. But over the long term, there's no way that can last.
No, absolutely not. You know, socialism, I think, is just the parasite that can only survive on the back of capitalism. Because when government workers are controlling the means of production, they effectively take away property rights and all of the rest. When you look at all of the ills of socialism, it can only effectively work when capitalism is working somewhere within that system. And when you're chasing people out of the city, that's just not going to happen. Okay, let's go and take a break. We'll wrap things up with Jonathan Williams after this. Welcome back in our final segment now with Jonathan Williams. He's the president and chief economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council. Find out more about the great work they do and encourage your legislators and representatives to become a member of ALEC as well. They'll get tremendous information and some legislative ideas as well by heading to ALEC.org, A-L-E-C.org. And we'll link that up on today's show page. Again, that's 15-46 at iSpyRadio.com. And so, Jonathan, in the time that we have left, I'd like to talk to you about some of Trump's other ideas, because we mentioned previously that about healthcare, but and a lot of Trump's ideas are pretty good, but he just floated the idea of a 50-year mortgage. And to me, you know, okay, so I'm hoping that there's more there, but on a $400,000 home with a 20% down at 7% interest, that would only save people about $200 per month, but adds almost $390,000 in more interest over the lifetime of the loan. And so your monthly payment in a 30-year mortgage is about $2,130. The total interest paid on that loan over 30 years is $446,400. In a 50-year mortgage, it's about $1,925. So again, about $200, $205. But the total interest paid over the life of that loan is $835,000. So like I said, he normally comes up with some pretty good ideas, but on the surface, this seems like a stinker. No one bats a thousand, right? But is there something more to this, maybe some element of the plan that he's not made public yet?
Well, it's a good question. I'm not privy to any of the details on how that may emerge in the proposal. It may be an opening act, and you know, many of these ideas are thrown out and see what the reaction is, right? And so I think that I probably wouldn't overthink it as a major initiative that we may see in D.C. But, you know, you're, the economics of it you outlined quite well there, which, I mean, you listen to the financial advisors and, you know, the kind of the common sense folks say, you know, you want to pay off your mortgage obviously as soon as you can, and you know they say if you have the money available you want to look for a 15-year versus a 30-year, right? And so you know Japan and other countries I think have gone down this route of a 50-year mortgage. That's just something that yeah it helps a tiny bit with the payment, but I mean you have to look at the overall interest cost, and I don't think it's something I would advise if I were in a financial advisory position to people that are asking me what to do, is especially young homeowners.
Yeah, maybe the idea is there that you start out with a 50-year mortgage, and then after 5-10 years, you then convert that to a 30-year mortgage. I could see something like that, maybe, or maybe lock in a lower interest rate over 50 years. Maybe some banks would be okay with that. So I don't know. I just, you know, on the surface, like I said, I think it's a bit of a stinker, but you know, who knows? It's hard to argue with him when he's been right so often.
Well, I mean, right, exactly. But, you know, here's what I think that what we need to talk about when it comes to housing is, you know, why is it that seniors are being taxed out of their homes in some cases? Why is it that so many young individuals cannot afford their first home and really that part of the American dream when it comes to that home ownership and really the forced savings that comes along with being a homeowner, which is incredibly beneficial long term for families? And, you know, when you look at some of the stats out there, Mark, the thing that shocks me is, you know, property taxes have gone up so much across the United States because some of these states are not following the ALEC truth and taxation guidance, and property tax assessments are going through the roof. We're now on a monthly payment. Folks are seeing the interest and the let me back up a second. They're seeing the insurance costs and the property tax portion of their payment higher than the principal and interest. So what's really driving so much of the housing costs and keeping people out of buying their first home is the fact that insurance costs are out of control. control in so many parts of the country, and then property taxes are out of control. And those are two things that at the state level, I think we can have a big difference when it comes to free market reforms to begin to tend the cost curve downwards when it comes to that part of it anyways. And obviously, interest rates are going to come down from where they've been at over the last couple of years. And then I think you address affordability in a major way just by those factors without having to go to things like long-term mortgages necessarily.
Yeah. Well, looking ahead, we got the end of the year coming up fast. Do you see any especially positive economic trends in 2026 from those 50 test tubes of democracy, the states?
Well, I really do. I mean, we're continuing to see this revolution unfold in front of us of free market ideas, whether it's tax cuts or deregulation, the DOGE level efforts at the state level. And we've got, 25 to 30 states that are moving in the direction and coming to ALEC for ideas and just great policy solutions. And so we're going to continue to see that movement in the right direction. The other thing that's going to be a new piece is as people go in and file their taxes for this year, they're going to be, either a new tax code under the One Big Beautiful Bill. You're going to see so many new educational opportunities for families because of the expansion of the 529 college savings accounts to K-12 expenses because of the Big Beautiful Bill. You're going to see a lot of those things kick in addition to the federal education tax credit that was a part of that as governors and legislators opt in. So, I mean, you're looking at a whole new framework of individuals will be able to benefit from with the implementation of the Big Beautiful Bill and with their states moving in the direction of common sense, free market ideas working with us at ALEC.
Well, I would like to get your thoughts on some worrisome trends, but we're very short on time. But speaking of worrisome, Oregon just passed and the governor finally signed a $4 billion tax increase. Originally, it was going to be $14 billion, but Representative Ed Deal has heard that there are more tax increases coming if they can't defeat this via a referendum. I can't imagine that's going to do well for Oregon's scores in terms of economic outlook.
Well, I wouldn't hold your breath at any time of Oregon breaking into the top half and rich states, poor states. I think the only question is going to be, will they give New York a run for the money at the bottom of
yes.
the index? And with that, decisions like that to increase taxes in an overly taxed state to begin with, that's a very bad sign of things to come.
Yeah, well, scoring socialism is part of New York's economy now. I can't imagine that's going to do them any good. So maybe they'll beat us for number 50, or at least we can hope so. Jonathan Williams, thank you so much for your time today.
Always great to join you.
New York City wasn't the only city to fall to socialism. Now the new socialist mayor in Seattle is saying she will ban grocery stores from closing in the city and the government will force them to stay open. And that's the problem with uninformed wannabe socialists. They don't see any problem with a government big enough to meet their every need, so they won't need to work as much. Except a government that big can also force you to work. Yet another little dirty dark secret of socialism. And yet another failure of our education system to educate people about socialism, which is why learning is so important and why they don't want you to. As we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.